Coming up on Tech Nation, data scientist and math blogger Dr. Kathy O'Neill talks about weapons of math destruction, how big data increases inequality and threatens democracy. Then on Biotech Nation, a new approach to achieving health with a compromised immune system. GigaGen is looking to build synthetic immune systems, filling in the missing pieces, while critically ill newborns get the genetic information they need and fast. That effort's coming from Etico Genome in San Diego. All this coming up on this week's Tech Nation.
Let's take five with Moira Gunn. This is 5 minutes.
Nobody argues that their baby shouldn't have a birth certificate. Well, okay, some people do, but the hassle of not having one in today's world is generally unworkable. Want to prove your citizenship? Enter school. Get a passport. Government-issued birth certificates have been accepted for decades, although baptismal certificates were once more frequently used. And then there was the lugging in of the family Bible. In pointing to each baby's name and birth date, carefully written inside the front cover. When people didn't move around much and the technology didn't exist, this worked just fine. Something similar happened with Social Security numbers. When President Franklin Delano Roosevelt signed the Social Security Act into law in 1935, the concept was to track people based on who would benefit. And thus my grandfather and grandmother shared a single Social Security number. You see, he worked at a job, and she was a housewife. Just seemed right to the designers of the system. Both of them would be benefiting from the contributions that my grandfather made as part of his employment. The idea of registering every newborn baby? I would venture to say they would find it laughable. In my generation, you didn't get a Social Security number until you applied for your first official non-cash job or you went to college. Many of us, myself included, made up a Social Security number on a form or two just to keep the process rolling. If you didn't have one, you had to apply in person and wait. And if you did have one, you'd have to find your card and then write it down. You didn't use it very much because it said very clearly, right on the card, not to be used for identification purposes. Pretty funny, since the point of the number was identification purposes, but you get the drift. Don't flash it around as an essential source of identification. When my firstborn came along, a generous grandparent with a career as a stockbroker thought the lad should start out life with some stock of his own. So we had to get him a Social Security number. And how did we do it? I held up the baby and my husband took a photo. We got the film developed and we sent it into the Social Security office. I mean, really? A bald, nondescript baby? And I have to be in the picture, or so I was told? Well, he's used it ever since, and no doubt it is ensconced in any number of databases. Today, some 90% of U.S. parents obtain a Social Security number for their baby at birth. And it's a regular part of the standard birth registration process. Social Security calls this EAB, which stands for enumeration at birth. At least they got that part right. It's enumeration. They're assigning your baby a number. And no matter how you might feel about it, it's part of the modern world. While 9 out of 10 American babies will likely think of it as the heir. It's just there. But before you worry about it, if history and the arc of technology bear out, the current state of things is only a blip on the screen. You see, when it comes to biotech, there's DNA. And when a baby pops out, well, heck, There's his or her DNA right there, the ultimate identifier. In the future, the idea of being assigned a number to track you will seem incredibly archaic. I'm Moira Gunn. This is 5 Minutes.
Five Minutes is produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. 5 Minutes is a production of Tech Nation Media. I'm Paul Lancour.
From San Francisco, I'm Moira Gunn, and this is Tech Nation. Today on Tech Nation, it's the weapons of math destruction. Data scientist Kathy O'Neill joins me to talk about what's right and wrong with today's big data and the algorithms which drive so many of the decisions around us today. Then on Biotech Nation, a new approach to building a synthetic immune system, and critically ill newborns get their DNA decoded on the spot. Data scientist Dr. Kathy O'Neill warns us about the predictive algorithms we're developing today with big data. Since we've been developing algorithms for as long as we've been developing computers, I asked her, what's different now that we've added big data?
The thing that big data sort of adds to it is this kind of, in my opinion, misleading idea that more data is always better. That we don't need to really have a theory of why things work, like a theory of causation, but rather we can just like basically throw all the data against the wall and see what kind of patterns we see emerging. This can be really problematic when the patterns that actually emerge are not the ones that we think of or intend to replicate. But that's what happens when we use machine learning on historical data. Machine learning algorithms are sort of morally neutral. They have no agenda. But what they do is they pick out patterns, even the ones that we prefer not to think about.
Let's talk about some of the algorithms people are paying for today.
It depends on the situation, but often it's, you know, basically to save time and become more efficient. So some of the algorithms that I think about a lot are basically sorting resumes. So instead of hiring a lot of HR people, human resources people, they want to sort of solve this problem, the sorting, the filtering problem with algorithms. And the way they do that is they look at the historical practices, you know, the historical data they have on hand for their company. And they say, well, who in the past was successful at our company? And of course, that requires them defining success. Usually that means like that person stayed with the company for a certain amount of time, maybe 2 years or more, and a person was promoted at least once or twice. And so what these algorithms are looking for, they're trained on historical data, they're looking for people who look like people who were successful in the past. If you perform a thought experiment on this, like let's say at Fox News, what this means is we're looking for people that were successful in the past at Fox News, and we're applying it to the current application pool of people who are maybe applying for anchor jobs. If you think about what that means in the sort of under the leadership of Roger Ailes, that you might be filtering out perfectly qualified female applicants just because in the past they were not set up to succeed in that culture.
Not to mention, you'll probably miss the star who's going to become a star because they're slightly different.
Absolutely. There's no way that machine learning can recognize new kinds of success signals. They can basically only recognize what we've already recognized in the past as success. So they basically replicate the past, which is another way of saying, like, if we had perfect ways of hiring people, perfect processes for hiring, then it would, by all means, be a good idea to automate that process. It would be save money and time. But as long as we have imperfect ways of finding, you know, the perfect fit for our companies, it's actually just replicating mistakes we've made in the past.
So we start out with an algorithm or an intention for an algorithm, and data scientists and the like implement that algorithm, and the company is sitting there going, well, this is really good. This is what it is, and it's what it's doing for us. And at this point, there's sort of a magical thinking that's going on. Like, this algorithm is solving our problem now.
Yeah, and it's that magical thinking is partly because people are just, they love they love technology, you know, and they're also, they love complicated mathematical things because they think mathematics is magic. Another reason that it seems to be working from the perspective of the company is that what you're getting, if you think about the filter and the way it's trained, you're getting exactly the same kind of people that you've gotten in the past. So it's familiar to you and it looks like it's working. And the final point is that the people that are refused, that are filtered out, you never know. For the most part, you never know, like, that you've made a mistake on them, that you should have hired them, because they're just gone. They don't, you don't end up collecting data on them because you never hired them.
So now we get to the data problems, the data itself. I mean, as you say, well, you never hired them, so they never get in the pool again, and we don't understand them. But also, even though we're saying historical data, this could be data from last week. This could be data from yesterday.
Oh, yeah. Historical data, in a data science world, could be yesterday. Netflix updates its algorithm every day with the new day's data. But it's called historical as soon as it's already happened. It's just a differentiate
between.
If it's
data, it is historical. I get it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
It's not data yet. It's some future data that we hope to collect.
No, I mean, I want to contrast what I just described with what you see in sports, because sports is, for me, like the anti-bad algorithm. It's like a really good algorithm, and for various reasons. But I think the most important one is that if your team, like, trades away a player because you decide that they are not meeting the metrics that you care about, and that person goes on to be very successful on the other team, you notice. So your algorithm is, you know, modified because you made a mistake. So it self-corrects, and it lives in an ecosystem of self-correction. Most of the algorithms that I talk about in my book do not have that property. They do not have, like, an ecosystem of modification where they get better and better over time.
And notice what you said. It's like, oh, he went on to become something successful. What's wrong with our algorithm? How can we change that? And what possibly is wrong with our ecosystem? It's a melding of algorithm and humans, you know, so it's not just here's the algorithm.
Yeah, right. I mean, and you could imagine that being implemented in a company as well for hiring, but it would have to be sort of intentionally designed. So you might imagine that there's an experiment going on where there's a machine learning algorithm that hires half the people, and then they're just human beings that hire the other half. And, you know, sometimes the people that are hired by humans are ones that the machine learning algorithm would have rejected, but they go on to be successful within the company. And that would be kind of like much closer to what I'm talking about with an ecosystem. It would be an opportunity for the machine learning algorithm to learn and to get better. It's just not what we see.
That's right. Or we'd have a lot more examples, which we don't. Which we don't. And of course, you know, we're in this big bang of data analytics and big data. In fact, I've started to call it big data and big data analytics. Nobody does anything small anymore. In fact, nobody does anything but analytics. Used to do analysis. Mm-hmm. No. Now we're doing analytics. Is there any difference in that technically?
Well, analysis is, you know, I guess if in terms of the job titles, like if you're an analyst, then you're kind of expected to sort of understand and describe some things that have happened. Whereas if you're a data scientist, then you're expected to be able to build predictive algorithms, which is a little bit fancier. But I don't really think it's very meaningful.
No, now we're in resume speak here. Mm-hmm. what you put on your resume. In fact,
terms of how much money you get paid, basically.
Yeah. Pay attention to which way the wind is blowing. In fact, I liked how you described how you decided to put data scientist on your resume. Those two little words, and life went well from there on in.
It was good timing too. But yeah, I left finance in 2011, and I was like, I have to do something nerdy because I am a nerd down to the core. So I decided, like, maybe I'm a data scientist. I started looking at the LinkedIn postings of jobs that, you know, required a data scientist, and I thought to myself, I can do those things. And so I renamed myself a data scientist and got a job maybe 2 days later.
Well, my advice to people who want to be hired as a CEO is to make sure visionary is in there somewhere.
Thought leader.
Thought leader, definitely, definitely. We're all over that. Mm-hmm. Now, you actually, but before you got into finance and data analytics and finance, you were a tenure-track professor at a university, and then you were hired as a quant on Wall Street. What's a quant?
Basically, a quant is a data scientist that works in finance. But I was hired in 2006. I started work in 2007, and this is before data scientist was a job title. So we were called quantitative analysts, but we were called quants for short. And I worked at the hedge fund D.E. Shaw, and I joined again in June 2007, like 3 months before the world started to fall apart. So I got kind of a really interesting perspective of the financial crisis from inside.
Well, it's interesting. Let's talk about that $3 trillion subprime mortgage collapse. You spoke about distinguishing between data that math and computers could handle and dissemble and analyze, and data or situations which it would take humans to untangle. Now, take us there. Can you give us a sense of that, about what's different?
Well, we had a really very well-oiled machine in terms of the mortgage market, and it was problematic, obviously. Fundamentally, it rested on what I consider a mathematical lie, which were the AAA ratings of the mortgage-backed securities. The AAA ratings were essentially like a promise from the credit rating agencies, Moody's, Fitch, and S&P, that like there were PhD mathematicians in the back room sort of very diligently looking through all the data underlying the mortgages and making sure that there's really no chance for default. So it was like a very like
good payers, good payers,
yeah,
all
exactly.
Good payers.
No, as we know, that was a lie. That was essentially they sold these AAA ratings for the money. And so that was sort of like the first real shock I had. I mean, I was a nerd mathematician walking into finance with ridiculous ideals of thinking that like I could bring the purity and beauty of mathematics to the real world of finance. And when I found out that this was these AAA ratings were being sold for money, and you know, but people were trusting them because they trusted mathematics, it really seemed like a betrayal. And what you mentioned is absolutely true, that the sort of the system of mortgages and the system of mortgage-backed securities and credit default swap and all those securitized products had become this well-oiled machine, this very, very scaled international system of selling these contracts. But when it started to fall apart and, you know, people started to actually default on them, and they started to ask for basically their mortgages to be reconsidered by the banks and to be given better deals, that's when humans had to actually, you know, answer phone calls and sort through paperwork. And largely speaking, they just didn't do it. There was all sorts of fraud and all sorts of bad incentives that were set up by the Bush and the Obama administrations that made it just kind of possible for banks to kind of step back and let people suffer rather than deploying any of their actual data analytics tools in order to help people, which, by the way, they probably could have done, but they simply didn't.
You're listening to Tech Nation. I'm Moira Gunn, and my guest today is Kathy O'Neill. Dr. O'Neill is a data scientist and the author of the blog MathBabe.org. She founded the LEAD program in data journalism at Columbia University and can be heard weekly on the Slate Money podcast. She's here today with Weapons of Math Destruction: How Big Data Increases Inequality and Threatens Democracy. Well, this book might as well have been entitled Kathy O'Neill and Kathy O'Neill's Conscience. Because it's not only your, you know, weaving through, you know, what's going on,
right,
and various different areas that you're not really, you know, involved in but can write about and talk about. And where's the ethics in all this? And it's
right.
It's challenging.
Yeah, I mean, I think like the time I've spent, you know, first as a quant, then now as a data scientist, it's gotten me quite disillusioned, because it seems that every chance we get, we technologists are doing as much as we can to keep the sort of messy real world at arm's length and to pretend the world is a math problem that we can solve and not think about the consequences. And we, you know, we define definition. We are the ones in charge of these algorithms that most people can't understand and can't possibly fathom. Even if they had the source code at their disposal, they wouldn't be able to understand it. And so we have all this secrecy and we have all this power. And we, generally speaking, just rig every system so that the people who are paying us, you know, make profit at the expense of the losers of the system. So we institute these systems and we think about the winners and we just don't consider the losers. And that's what I'm railing against. It's my manifesto, as you pointed out.
Well, you're not alone. You write about two financial engineers, Emmanuel Derman and Paul Wilmot, after the stock market crash in 2008. And they wrote an oath. And there's maybe five or six items on the oath. But the last one really caught my attention. I understand that my work may have enormous effect on society and the economy, many of them beyond my comprehension. This is really important when you understand what it is you're doing.
Yeah, and they wrote that as financial engineers. And, you know, they weren't even aware, I don't think, of many of the algorithms that I researched in my book that had to do with things like assessing teachers at their jobs that may lead to their firing, or like sentencing people to jail based on risk recidivism risk, all sorts of things that are very, very like personal and individual. So it you know, all I'm saying is that the kind of repercussions that that our algorithms have are already terrible and kind of difficult and complex when you're talking just strictly about finance. But if you actually enlarge and broaden your perspective to all of data science, which really pertains to individuals, not the market, then it gets even deeper.
Well, you know, this dovetails with one of our Tech Nation facts of life. We have a set of them. We don't know if they're complete or not. We don't think so. And that is, those who build a technology, and in this case, the technology is algorithms, cannot predict how it will be ultimately used. And this is part of what they're saying. It's like, wow, we did this for this intent, and as it goes out, it's affecting a whole lot of people in ways that was never intended by the originator.
You know, and that's true, but I don't want to use that as an excuse not to think about it, which is what I've heard. You know, I've talked to people who build these algorithms, and in particular the recidivism risk algorithms, which judges use to sentence people in jail. And they tell me that they intentionally do not think about how they're being used, because that's not their problem. They're the PhD and they're the expert, and they're not concerned because they're not responsible for the ethics. And I think that goes too far. I think you're right that you can't understand everything, but you can absolutely anticipate some direct uses of your algorithm.
Hey, why don't we just send them to prison and see if they can try to get out on their algorithm? I mean, it's like, yeah.
Well, if
we have anybody working on technology who is not trying to understand what its negative effects are, it's like they should be, I don't know, removed from working on technology.
Well, you know, you make a really important point, which is that by and large, the technologists, if they were scored by these scoring algorithms, they're mostly scoring algorithms, they would actually probably get very nice scores. That's one of the problems, you know, like when we data scientists build algorithms that send police back to the poor black neighborhoods of the cities, we have not, for the most part, been subject to stop and frisk ourselves. So we don't really understand how biased that data set is. We just think of it as crime data rather than police practices. But it's just as much a reflection of police practices as it is of crime.
Well, I won't give away all your stories, but there were a couple I thought which were pretty interesting. Let's talk about college rankings and the U.S. News and World Report. Many people know about the rankings, but a lot of people don't know how it got started and why.
Yeah. So the U.S. News and World Report was a magazine that was like, oh, like we're going to go to business if we don't come up with something. And they, you know, they came up with this college rankings with such a success. The magazine doesn't even exist anymore, but they've proliferated and they now like rank all sorts of things, like law schools, even high schools. It's been enormously popular. And I have to say, enormously influential and in a mostly negative way. In the sense that colleges have sort of created this arms race among themselves to to game this algorithm to raise their rankings, and it is to the detriment of most of the students, in particular the high school seniors trying to get into those colleges, who have to worry about telling each college how much they really, really want to go to that college, because one of the metrics that these colleges are measured by.
Check every single website at a college. They've got whatever metric looks good for them from the rankings. Totally.
Yes, absolutely. But in particular, like, they do not want to offer admission to someone who ends up not going. And just that metric alone has really degraded the quality of life of high school seniors and their parents, I might add, because my oldest is a junior right now. And the most important thing, I think, to mention about the U.S. News and World Report is what they do not consider in the metrics, in the ranking, and they do not consider tuition. And this means that college and college administrators, if they want to do well in the rankings, they can ignore the cost. Their tuition can double, but as long as their rankings go up, they're not dinged. So, and that's one of the reasons, I believe, that we've seen such a great tuition cost, skyrocketing.
Now let's talk Google. Everybody uses Google.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Well, okay. Google and Facebook, if you don't mind me enlarging this to Facebook, they're the ones that get all this money for, the targeted advertising. Most of the people think of targeted advertising as relatively benign. And it is, for the most part, again, for people like myself, highly educated technologists with extra money in my pocket. The worst thing that can happen to me is that I might fall subject to yet another alpaca ball of yarn because I'm addicted to knitting. But on the other end of the spectrum, it's really very predatory. And tailored advertising as a system is set up to very, very accurately target people by demographic. So the two of the things that I worry about a lot in my book are payday lending companies that absolutely use the tailored advertising ecosystem to find victims, and the for-profit colleges, which go after, veterans as a group, and also single black mothers who they then promise a better life to them and their child if they just, sign up for this for-profit college. And I should say that for-profit colleges, generally speaking, are not good educations and land people with a bunch of debt and a diploma, if they even get it, that is worth no more than a high school education. So it's really extremely predatory on that end of the spectrum.
So it's the use of Google and Facebook by these people that has the consequences.
Right. And I should mention that Google recently decided not to let payday lenders advertise on them on Google. So kudos to them. But we still have lots of other examples of predatory advertising.
I've been speaking with Dr. Kathy O'Neill, the author of Weapons of Math Destruction: How Big Data Increases Inequality and Threatens Democracy. We'll talk more after a break. Podcasts of Tech Nation and Biotech Nation are available at iTunes, Stitcher, and other podcast syndication outlets. Coming up in the second half of our show on Biotech Nation, creating synthetic antibodies for everything from fighting severe infections to addressing cancer tumors. And critically ill newborns get their DNA sequenced fast. Stay with us. Thank you. You're listening to Tech Nation. I'm speaking with Kathy O'Neill, the author of Weapons of Math Destruction, How Big Data Increases Inequality and Threatens Democracy. We've been talking about predatory internet advertising.
And I should mention that Google recently decided not to let payday lenders advertise on them on Google. So kudos to them. But we still have lots of other examples of predatory advertising. The other thing that I worry about with both Facebook and Google are the political ads. We have this new kind of technology that most people on the left think of as a great thing because Obama used it well and it was an advantage for him. But of course, any technology, as you pointed out, could be used by anyone. So there's no reason to think that going forward, we're going to have a distinct advantage on the Democratic side. But what we do have is we have campaigns that have profiles on every single person in this country, every voter, and that have enormous information asymmetry compared to us. In other words, they know way more about us than we know about them. And what that means is they can target us and show us exactly what they want us to see about their politician, their candidate. And so the way I say it is, like, what's efficient for campaigns, because, by the way, this works. It works very well. What's efficient for campaigns is actually inefficient for democracy. Democracy is best served by public debates where all the candidates actually examine, like, they expose their entire platform, and, like, we civic citizens get to decide what we like the most overall. It's not sufficient just to be told exactly what they want us to hear.
Well, they must have figured out that I'm apolitical because I haven't seen anything. Nobody's pushing anything to me.
So, you know, and that's the other thing. That's another detriment to this whole system. They're not going to show it to you if you're not in a swing state and if you're not a swing voter. So if either of those is true, then you're very unlikely to get that much targeting. Unless you are likely to give money to the campaign, in which case you are, again,
on the blacklist. It's like, oh, no, she's not giving us nothing. No.
Right. I mean, I guess my overall point, though, is like the sort of definition of important voters in this country has been winnowed down by this technology to the point where most people are just, like, considered not relevant to democracy, which is the opposite of what democracy is supposed to do.
Now, one part of your book really fascinated me. We know that you left the hedge fund on Wall Street, and then you became an organizer and facilitator for the Occupy movement. And all I could imagine is it's like, I quit, and you walked out the door on Wall Street, and you looked, and you said, I got to do something else. And a bunch of people were in the park across the street, and you go, okay, what are you doing? You know, how do you possibly? I think most people, like, how do you sidle up?
That wasn't actually so far from what happened. Yeah.
Really?
No, my last job in Wall Street was at the Chase Building, which was on, you know, the street next to Wall Street. So it really was, I actually would eat in Zuccotti Park for lunch when I worked there. So it was really the neighborhood. Occupy didn't start, though, until 5 months after I left finance. But I certainly was very familiar with the area. And I did go down there and I did meet people. And then at some point, there was, like, a little mailing list being formed for people who were really interested in having discussions about financial reform. And we had one meeting, which was way too full, so we split into two groups. And I took half the group because I had stepped up as a facilitator, which just means I've led the discussion. I moderated it. And then I found, with the help of a professor of economics at Columbia, I found a room at Columbia, and we've been meeting every Sunday since then, including this Sunday. This Sunday, we're going to kick off a new kind of study group we're having about the Black Lives Matter movement and, like, what their demands are. So we're studying their writings.
You know, it's amazing to me because you're a real live person. You sound like, you know, like you could be somebody's next door neighbor and say, oh, yeah, this is it. And it's like, you're in the Occupy movement. You know,
I have three kids.
You have three kids. What do they think about that?
To be clear, I didn't sleep in Zuccotti Park because I have three kids, as I said. They think I'm crazy. I have blue hair, too. I mean,
you have blue hair. Everybody will know this is a remote interview at this point.
Yeah.
Oh, wow, you have blue hair.
I do that because teenagers talk to me when I have blue hair, and I love teenagers. They're, like, the most unedited, honest people in the world.
One of the things that happens when you have a successful trajectory as you've had, you went and got a PhD, you went to university, then you went to Wall Street, then you did this, you're writing this book. It's been long listed at this point for the National Book Award. We're looking at someone that would normally be, you know, held up, you know, this is a role model. And they, you know, they roll up a young girl and they look at you and they say, this is what you could become. And not everybody can make it into this. And I try to explain this. It's like you've got to look at the qualities of the young boy or the young girl and encourage that. And that really struck me when I was reading your story about being a little girl and looking at license plates and reducing the numbers to their primes. And it reminded me of myself, you know, and on Saturday morning, I'd sit at the kitchen table and analyze long lists of numbers, figuring out the next number in the pattern. And I mean, I literally, it triggered endorphins, you know.
Oh, sure.
And it's like,
wonderful.
So it's like, it's not about, hey, look over there, you can, you know, go for the gold. It's a question of, there are plenty of little boys and little girls out there that this stuff really does trigger endorphins.
Well, you know, and it's interesting that you put it that way, because if I wanted to be a role model, I would argue that I could be a role model to absolutely anyone, but I would frame it that I'm a role model because I did what I thought was right. And I think anyone can do that.
Now, what do you mean by right?
Well, I mean, when I did stuff that I found interesting. So that's, I mean, I should mention that working as a quant and then working as a data scientist has always been fascinating on a mathematical level. And I've gotten a lot of, you know, endorphins, as you said, from that work. But at the same time, I had a kind of uneasy feeling in the back of my conscience, if that's a part of my body. And at some point I was like, no, this isn't the right thing for me. I have to find my nerd passion in a place, in a way, in a fashion where I feel like I'm improving the world rather than taking advantage of it. So, I mean, that's kind of what I've been, my lifelong pursuit is like, how can I do stuff that I'm technically good at and I enjoy and also feel good about what I'm doing?
I don't want to leave people with the idea that there's nothing we can do about all these algorithms. When I was in graduate school, the engineering students had built a model of a oil refinery. So you had sludge coming in, and at the end you had gasoline and all this stuff going out, and then big pipes and small pipes, and you tried to optimize how they were all laid out. And boy, I'll tell you, this stuff was just flying through. And the old engineering professor comes in, he's looking, he's not saying anything, and they're all really happy, you know, boy, we know how to optimize. And he goes, this is really interesting. He goes, it can't exist in nature because there's no friction in your system. And they're like, what? What? And they looked and they looked and they looked, and they realized that they had optimized the inside diameter of the pipes to be greater than the outside diameter. Now this was consistent mathematically, but so it was a simple fix. It's like you just said, hey, you can optimize, but you can't get past this point. But it points out that you have to go back and you have to be able to redo these algorithms again and again and again, given what you understand that's wrong in the basic one, as well as what you learn over time or that situations change.
Really good point. And I am absolutely dedicated to data and data science. And so, I mean, the first thing I would say is that we have just started with algorithms. And what I am complaining about is that we have a long way to go. We cannot assume that algorithms that we whip up and throw out there and deploy without testing are initially perfect. Just imagine a car company that they made a frame of a car and then they just started selling it and asking people to drive it without thinking very hard about whether it was safe. We wouldn't do that. We would test it. We would understand it. We would absolutely make sure it was foolproof. This is something we haven't done with algorithms, but we can do. So the other thing I want to mention is like the rest of my life, I'm hoping to develop methodology and tools that will be able to audit algorithms to make sure that they're doing what they should be doing and to create those ecosystems I mentioned so that these algorithms get feedback and they get better over time and they get better and better over time. Because, I mean, look at the self-driving car with Google. Like, that didn't happen overnight, right? We had a lot of driving around and making mistakes. And that's true for any algorithm. The question is whether we're going to do it, you know, honestly and fairly and, you know, making sure that it's safe for everyone.
And another piece of advice, if you have blue hair, do what Kathy did. Put the picture on the cover of the book or on the flap of the book in black and white so I couldn't tell she had blue hair, which I would have talked to you anyway. I mean, this is down my alley here, you know. But very clever, very clever. I hope you win that National Book Award and you show up with your blue hair, because I don't think they'll know. I think it's a total secret here. Well, Kathy, thank you so much. Please come on. We'd love to see you again.
And my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
My guest today is Dr. Kathy O'Neill. The book is Weapons of Math Destruction: How Big Data Increases Inequality and Threatens Democracy. It's published by Crown. I'm Moira Gunn. You're listening to Tech Nation. The world we know is changing. Welcome to Biotech Nation. Today on Biotech Nation, a new approach to dealing with a compromised immune system and an effort to decode the genes of critically ill newborns faster than ever before. Dr. David Johnson is the founder, president, and CEO of GigaGen. I started out by asking him, what comprises the immune system of a human?
The most common cells are cells that produce antibodies, which are B cells, and then T cells, which produce T cell receptors. So those are the ones that most people are familiar with. And they do, I'd say, the bulk of the interesting work in the immune system.
Antibodies, we always know that there are many different kinds.
The estimates vary, but some people think there are hundreds of millions or even billions of different antibodies and T cells in your immune system. And that's what keeps you healthy, because you have all different kinds of viruses and bacteria and other pathogens that make their way into your body.
Now, how does that relate to the T cells?
T cells and antibodies work together. A very simple way to think about it is that antibodies will coat a pathogen of interest, let's say a bacteria, and then T cells actually will recognize those antibodies and those pathogens, and then they go and replicate themselves and create more of each other and then induce this entire immune response. So again, there are many different kinds of cells that are coming into the system here, but what recognizes the pathogen are those antibodies and the T cells. Mm-hmm.
One thing I've gotten from speaking with you earlier, Dave, is that everybody has a whole different set of antibodies.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's the really interesting thing, is that not only do you have a completely different set from, say, your mother or your sister, you actually have a different set from week to week. So if you looked at what your antibodies or your T cells are today, they're going to be completely different in the winter. Maybe you've been exposed to flu. Or maybe you went to a foreign country and got exposed to different kinds of pathogens. Your immune system responds to that and changes. So it's incredibly diverse and extremely interesting from my perspective.
Now, the T cells, the antibodies, they have DNA as well?
Yeah. So one way to think about this is that every one of the B cells or T cells, they actually go through a process called recombination, which rearranges their whole genome. So every B cell and T cell has a different genome in a way. So you're not just comprised of one genome. You're not walking around and you don't have just one genome. You actually have hundreds of millions of genomes as you walk around. So there's a lot of complexity here and a really big challenge scientifically and technically.
If there's one thing I know with today's genetic tools, that any organism, we can take and decode their DNA.
Yeah.
And that's important here.
Yeah, yeah. And that's a really interesting point. So the real challenge here is that normally when you take an organism, and let's say you want to sequence your genome, what you normally do is take some of your tissue, something, a skin sample or something, and then you grind it up and you make DNA and then you sequence it. But the thing to think about is you're taking many, many cells, and most existing genetic technologies need many, many single cells in order to get that measurement. But our problem, if you think about it, is we've got many, many different genomes in single cells. So what I'm driving at here is we had to invent a completely new technology that allows us to look one cell at a time and sequence the relevant genes from each of those cells.
This antibody and this antibody and
millions at a time.
It would take more than my lifetime to even say that on all the antibodies we had to have.
Yeah, exactly.
The same with the T cells.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so there's a lot of diversity there, and you really have to have special technology to get your head around what's going on in an immune system.
So number one, you take for just immune system number one, you had to invent whole new technology to decode a whole bunch of the antibodies and a whole bunch of the T cells.
Yeah.
Then you move to the next guy, might be a whole different set of ones.
Yeah, although what you do is we created a platform that enables us to do this over and over again. So certainly, and it's the same thing with when our colleagues sequenced the first genome. This was 20 years in the making, and I forget what the number of dollars it was, but billions of dollars in the making. And nowadays, you can do that for a few thousand dollars. So as you do more and more of them, you get better and better. And your technology gets better and better. So that's really what we've been all about, is it took us a few years to generate that first...
number one.
Yeah, we had that first individual, and it took us years to figure out how to do that. But now we can do this in a course of a few hours. We can generate a synthetic immune system from an individual by taking their cells and then processing them through our system. And then and then doing the DNA sequencing to measure what the antibodies and T cell receptors are in those individuals.
Now, another thing I know from the genetic tools we have is that if we have the DNA breakdown on a computer, we can turn around and generate that DNA, actual real live DNA.
Yeah.
So you could go from your information and back to real live DNA.
Yeah, and that's right.
That means you could give people their antibodies and T cells?
Yeah, that's right. And that's one of the big goals of our company. And this is where it becomes commercially interesting. I mean, there's obviously amazing basic research that's coming out of this. But the real important application is in we call these synthetic immune systems. So you can't just take cells from an individual and then replicate them infinitely and give them to lots and lots of people. You can do something called a bone marrow transplant, but
that's what that's doing. It's trying to move
exactly
introduce a new immune system.
But you can only do that once. So you would get a bone marrow from a relative or somebody who's genetically similar to you, and you can only do that once. So that's hard to scale. In other words, what we do is we actually create these synthetically. So we'll take the information from the cells and then make big libraries of DNA. And then the DNA gets introduced into protein-producing cells. They're called Chinese hamster ovary cells. You can look them
up.
Gotta
get a new description, man.
Yeah, they're called. That's what the field uses. And these are they're interesting. They're the engines of biotech. Every antibody therapy that's made is made in these cells. So we don't do anything different there. The difference is that we're making many, many different kinds of antibodies and many, many different kinds of T cell receptors, which we can then use therapeutically. The first application is something called immune deficiency. So people can't make their own antibodies at all. And so for those individuals, you take a pool of synthetic immune systems from many individuals.
And very healthy ones.
Very healthy ones with good responses to vaccines, that sort of thing. And then you give that protein to these immune deficient individuals and they can be healthy for the rest of their lives. The other application is in cancer. So in the news, you might have heard about Jimmy Carter and how he took a drug which... basically, what it does is it takes the brakes off the immune system. So his immune system actually went in and killed his tumor, and he was on his deathbed. But there was some cells, some T cells and/or B cells that were in his system, which essentially cured his cancer. Given that chance, right? Exactly. Now, I think the really interesting question is, what were those cells?
Dave is on the lookout. Give me those cells, Jimmy.
So you want to find these really, again, the same thing with the immune deficiency. You want to find people who are really good responders, like Jimmy Carter, and then take their immune systems and then give those to people who aren't doing so well. And that I think is really exciting because you're taking what nature is doing well you know, it's doing well in one individual or a bunch of individuals. And then you're saying, well, there are all these other people who aren't so lucky. Let's take that information and give it to somebody else. And that's so different than most drugs, which are just made synthetically and don't necessarily leverage nature to help cure the diseases.
Now, we've gone through what the process where we start and all the way through.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, is the product a recognized kind of therapy that we currently go through trials for?
Yeah.
Do you have to treat things?
Yeah.
I mean, are there diseases recognized by the FDA that you can develop treatments for?
Yeah.
You can't just go out there and say, well, we'll see how it goes.
No. You can't just put this on a shelf and, you know, expect people to use it. It's a very tightly regulated process. The FDA has protocols for regulating these kinds of therapies. So we're obviously following those processes very carefully. You know, we've got excellent FDA experts who are guiding us through the process. And it takes a long time. You know, that's the challenge in any drug company, is that you get very excited about what you're doing. The work is really interesting, and you wish that you could give it to sick people tomorrow. But typically these processes take 5 to 10 years before you can actually get the drug out to a point where doctors can use it routinely.
So you've got a lot of years ahead of you.
We have a lot of years ahead of us, yeah. And there's a lot of different ways that these things work, too. A lot of times startups actually end up partnering with larger companies. That's a new trend these days, is that you know, we're almost entirely funded by federal grants. And so my case that I make in the grants is that I say, I'm going to get data that I can then show to large pharmaceutical companies and then get them interested. And then often small companies like mine will partner with the large companies, and it expedites the process. Let's just say that, because they certainly know how to bring things through FDA, and they know how to sell drugs, market drugs, and do clinical studies.
Well, in the spirit of Henrietta Lacks, I'd like to offer you my antibodies at $10 on antibody. You might as well just, you know, pay me up front, Dave. You know, in fact, I've got gazillions of them, so write the check.
All right. I've got my checkbook right here ready to go. So they better be good antibodies.
That's right.
At that price.
I'm going to be after you for the intellectual property rights. Dave, really terrific. Please come back. Keep us up to date.
Yeah, thanks. This has been fun. Thanks for the time.
Dr. David Johnson is the founder, president, and CEO of GigaGen. More information is available on the web at GigaGen.com. That's GigaGen, GigaGen.com. Critically ill newborns need all the information about their health status immediately, and more technology is being worked on every day, Etikogenome among them. We talked about its dragon chip before. It sounds like dragon, but no, it's spelled DRAGEN, the dragon chip. Gavin Stone is Etikogenome's vice president for marketing.
It's actually an acronym, stands for Dynamic Read Analysis for Genomics. And it's a reconfigurable processor, so it takes a similar kind of technology that has been developed for cell phones and things like that, and we've applied it into the genomic space. So instead of you having a whole room full of servers to analyze your data coming off sequencing instruments, and it is a lot of data, it's huge. It's literally a 200 gigabyte file for each person's genome that typically takes a couple of days to analyze. So we've implemented this chip in a reconfigurable processor, an FPGA, field programmable gate array, that enables us to process it in about 20 minutes. And we're able to do it even more accurately than you can just using standard CPUs as well. So in every metric, it's better than it's been done before by orders of magnitude. So it's way faster, way cheaper.
Faster, better, cheaper.
Exactly, yeah. And lower power, which is huge. So
that's right. Anytime you get it in something really tiny, it's really good.
Exactly.
Exactly. Now, you know, technology is great on its own. I get very excited about it, but that's just me. It has to have an application. Tell us about the apps. Where are you going?
Exactly. I mean, it's got actually hundreds of applications. One of the ones that I like to highlight, which really showcases the speed and what you can actually do with the speed. I mean, the question is, why do you want to get a genome analysis faster? And The one that is really the most critical is with acutely ill newborns in NICUs, neonatal intensive care units, where it's a race against time to try and find a diagnosis for these newborns that the doctors just don't know what to do with them. And in the past, there's been these diagnostic odysseys or a barrage of tests that have to be sent out for, and they're all tests that require a doctor to make some kind of a judgment on what he thinks is wrong with a newborn. And a newborn doesn't have any patient history, so it's very difficult.
And they're fragile.
Exactly. And a whole genome sequence allows the information to show you what is wrong with the newborn rather than the doctor trying to guess at what is wrong and then verify that with a test.
Now, is this just a projected application or have you actually done this?
No, it has been done. We work very closely with Children's Mercy Hospital in Kansas City. Dr. Stephen Kingsmore, very famous for pioneering this work. He actually won a Guinness World Record that we helped him achieve just a few weeks ago for this very thing. So it's called the 26-hour genome. So we are able to go from a blood draw to a diagnosis on a critically ill newborn in 26 hours, which is hugely phenomenal, when literally every minute counts in saving the life of one of these babies.
We have to now disseminate this. I mean, that means the technology has to be on the spot.
Yes, exactly. And we're working very closely with Rady Children's Hospital down in San Diego, where Dr. Kingsmore is now, to create a system that is easy to use and can go from a blood draw to a diagnosis in this 26 hours that consists of a Dragon system, a sequencing system, and all of the bioinformatics and diagnostic tools that are required, all packaged together in a simple, almost like an appliance, you can think of it as such, that we can then replicate at all the children's hospitals. There's probably upwards of 200 NICUs in the U.S. alone. And then you have PICUs, which is the pediatric care units as well. There's a similar number of those. And the plan is to then also have a cloud that all of these connect into and all the data can be shared between the hospitals. And with genomics, sharing that data is as important as making that initial diagnosis because it makes the system smarter and smarter.
When we see all of our DNA together,
exactly.
It means a lot.
Because the genome is just so huge, 3 billion base pairs, if you have a genome that you analyze in isolation, you can only tell so much. But if you analyze 1,000 or 100,000 genomes and do it jointly, you can then figure out so much more diseases and treatments that you can implement on new critically ill newborns.
Well, Gavin, thank you so much. Please come back. Keep us updated.
Oh, you're welcome.
Gavin Stone is the Vice President for Marketing of Etico Genome. More information is available on the web at eticogenome.com. That's E-D-I-C-O, Etico, eticogenome.com. For Biotech Nation, I'm Moira Gunn.
Tech Nation and its regular segment Biotech Nation are produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. Executive producer is Matt Gardner. The director of technical production is Monte Carlos. And audio engineers include Howard Gelman, Seal Muller, and Larry Upton. Our theme music was composed by Ann Nachtrieb-Zesiger and Robert Powell, with title creation provided by NameLab Incorporated of San Francisco. Program information and internet audio is available on the web at technation.com. Tech Nation and Biotech Nation are productions of Tech Nation Media. I'm Paul Landcourt.